Welcome to another episode of Psych Tech. My name is Josue Cardona, and with me is Kelly Dunlap. What's up, Kelly?
I am so excited!
Why are you excited?
I mean, Kelly? I'm excited every time we record, but today's topic really, it hits me in all the feels. I love this topic so much.
I think we're still getting our bearings, right? We're still trying to figure out what we're doing to a certain extent. So we kind of come up with just ideas that we have that we want to cover on the show. And this week was your idea. And I know we kind of like agree or disagree. I think the only idea I've ever disagreed on with you is the time you wanted to do a Game of Thrones episode, which didn't make sense to me. But other than that, I think we're good. And today I'm excited too to talk about this. So start us off. Why do you want to talk about crowdsourcing?
Well, first I want to clarify. I was severely scolded by my husband because I used the word crowdsource and crowdfund interchangeably. And so I was promptly corrected. So I guess, at least in my lovely mad scientist notebook, I have examples of both crowdfunding and crowdsourcing that I want to talk about. So I guess it's not going to be a nice, clean little title, but the idea of utilizing social networks to get stuff done.
Okay.
Whatever okay. That stuff might be.
Okay. All right.
So I recently completed a Kickstarter. So successfully funded a Kickstarter. We raised over $12,000. And this is for the video game website that I own and co-run. And that got me thinking about how crazy it is that people, most of which I have never met, helped give me $12,000 to go exhibit at a convention in a couple months. And the amount of faith and trust that takes, and the kind of community grassroots that is there to make it happen. And so I started thinking about, well, what is the psychology of giving? What is there? I know there's a lot of research about empathy and that word I'm totally blanking on that starts with an A.
Hey.
Help me out here, Josue. Help me out.
Word with an A.
Altruism. There we go.
Altruism. Okay.
That was just a test to see if people at home could guess the word before I did. But yeah, altruism. And the idea of giving, you know, human beings being inherently good versus inherently evil, philosophical, blah, blah, blah. But that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. And mostly because if you're talking about crowdsourcing / funding, it is all up in that social psychology. It's all about relationships. And I love talking about human relationships.
Yeah. And a lot of people try Kickstarters and they completely fail. A lot of people don't break. Not only do they not get funded, but they barely make any money. And there's a whole, you know, science to that. You can probably read a couple books, take a few classes on how to do that correctly. But the key, from what I understand, is that you need a community to back you up. And if you don't have a following or a community that you're connected to, those things are never going to fly, because Kickstarter on its own, any other crowdfunding platform, it doesn't just like it's advertising and kind of thing doesn't work. It's more of a tool to get that community together. And I have no problem with you talking about this, because this isn't the first time you've done this. This is the third time,
yes,
right, that you've successfully funded a campaign. So
yep.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
By the way, first of all,
it is exciting, and there definitely is a science to it. And we've learned along the way what that is and what it takes and how to budget appropriately and all sorts of stuff like that. Cal and I even done a panel on how to run a successful Kickstarter. So a small scale Kickstarter, not, you know, the millions and millions that say like Rooster Teeth or, you know, the movie people get. But it's incredibly empowering to feel that you can create something and that people out there want you to create it. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, Josue, when you said you need a community. And that is one of the biggest things, is that in order for people to buy in, they, one, need to trust you at a very basic level. With strangers, that can be difficult. But two, there's this idea of identifying with something, that you as an individual can make a difference in this project that you care about and that you identify with in some way. So, for example, in our Kickstarter, a large portion of the people who donated are people who play on the site. They are griftballers. They identify with that community. A lot of them are just Halo players, so they might not necessarily play in our griftball leagues, but they identify with the Halo universe. This is the place that gives them enjoyment and friends and discussion and all those warm, fuzzy feelings of social belonging. And then there's some crazy people out there who I adore a great deal, who I have no idea who they are, who donated an absurd amount of money and asked for absolutely nothing in return.
Really?
Yeah. One of our largest donors, I can't say the names or the dollar amount, but one of our largest donors is somebody who has donated every year, and it's always been a large amount, and he has asked for nothing in return.
Yeah, because on Kickstarter, you can choose a reward, but you don't have to.
Yes.
You can just give it, you can just, like, you can claim a reward after a certain dollar amount, but you don't have to.
Right. Yeah. And so I will say it was over $1,000 that he donated.
Did you have any rewards for, like, what kind of rewards were there? Like, or do you think, and answer this all together, do you think that people donated, this person being, you know, being an outlier, the other people, were they trying to get those rewards, or, like, were the rewards tangible? Were they people who were going to go to RTX, to the event?
Well, that's kind of where there's a breakdown in my experience, and that's backed up by the literature, which is always awesome, is that there are some people who donate for altruistic reasons. They donate because they can, like this gentleman who donates obscene amounts of money and wants nothing in return. The fact that he can do that, and if you go and I've looked at his profile, and he's backed hundreds of Kickstarters at different amounts. So this guy is kind of like an angel investor, and he just goes around giving money to projects that somehow speak to him. And it obviously gives him some kind of happiness to do so, which is great.
And actually, just to clear that up, like, it's not an investment, because in Kickstarter,
no.
you're not investing. You have no...
There's no
like,
stake.
You can invest. I mean, you can donate to a Kickstarter like Oculus Rift, and then they can go get sold by Facebook, and you get absolutely nothing but what you paid for initially. Like, that is not an investment.
Right.
Just want to make that clear.
Yeah, no, I said like an angel investor.
Not an investment. Not an investment.
Not an investment, but like... anyway. Point.
Like an angel.
Like an angel.
Like an angel.
An angel who drops money on your head. And
yes.
The other is that people who are donating in order to get something in return. So that's not altruism. That I think you could call it charity. I'm not sure. I know that word has some different definitions, but the idea that you're giving with the wanting of getting something in return versus giving because you want to give. And the rewards are there for the people on one side of the spectrum and then most people in between. I like to think that a lot of people gave to this Kickstarter in particular because of that sense of community, that sense of, hey, you know, this is something I really care about. This is a social group that I identify with and I want to help them, from that altruistic sense. But I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty sure the idea of getting a fully customized esports Griffball jersey with your name and team name and things like that on it, that's a pretty strong incentive to maybe, you know, if you were going to donate $100, maybe you would kick it up a notch. And I know, almost for me, it makes me feel better that I get to give them something in return. So from kind of both sides of it.
Yeah, we've all done fundraisers for schools and stuff like that. Right?
Oh, that's awful. I don't ever want
I used to be
a Girl Scout. That was the worst thing ever.
But it's the same idea. It's like, oh, I could get this cheaper somewhere else, or I don't need this right now, but I'll help out and I'll buy it.
Do you want a magazine subscription? No. No, I don't.
Yeah. Candy and...
Yeah. Tubs of cookie dough. Now that one was a good
tubs
decision.
Tubs of cookie dough, frozen pizzas. And then Girl Scouts, I mean...
Well, they got the corner
got
market.
Got those cookies. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so the idea that they're, like I said, strangers, friends, everybody in between... help support this project. And again, that speaks to these really deep psychological wantings to contribute. I know one of the big things in IOPsych, which is, industrial organizational psychology, which looks at how businesses are run and how management styles work. And it doesn't sound super flashy, but it's really cool because they find that people who give their time or their money, so either donate to charities or volunteer or do things like that, they tend to be happier. And this comes across in businesses and the like. I don't know where I was going with that. I felt like if I just keep talking, maybe. No, it went away. I was talking about IO for some reason and I don't remember why.
You had notes. You had tons of notes.
I know, but that wasn't in my notes. I think in my... This needs to be edited out.
Okay. All right. Only because you said so.
I fail. Yeah, let me...
We have to start all over because...
I don't know where I was going to start with.
From the beginning.
Okay. So this Kickstarter was really exciting because, you know, you get to see all these people who are involved in the community, people who aren't involved in the community, but everybody rallying together to make something happen. And that's the idea of what crowdsourcing is getting a bunch of people together to make stuff work. And crowdfunding, I just think, is like a little under part of the crowdsourcing umbrella because you are crowdsourcing funds. So that's how I'm going to justify it to myself. And I'm sure later, after my husband hears this, to him as well. Love you, sweetie.
Yeah, but there is a big difference because Everything that you're doing, like, you're not asking for volunteers, right? Necessarily, you're just asking for donations through the Kickstarter. And once somebody gives money, that's it. Like that's their part, and then you're doing the work.
Yes.
So it'll be different than like if you're building your website and then people were all working on it. Like Wikipedia is a perfect example of crowdsourcing.
That's totally in my notes.
Right, where anybody can create an account, log in, and then add to the product. And the idea is that they will make it better. Because even if I F it up, somebody else is going to come in and fix it, or vice versa.
So you know what crowdsourcing is kind of like?
What's it kind of like?
The Borg.
Oh, it's not kind of like the Borg.
Yes, it is. You're working collectively to achieve a common good.
Yeah, but the Borg, you assimilate, but then crowdsourcing, you could have, like, different factions, and you could have, like, you could get kicked out of Wikipedia for just messing up all the time. You don't have that option.
Borg did get disconnected all the time. There are several episodes of Star Trek talking about Borg who have been separated from the collective.
Fine.
If you want to argue, I will keep going, but you can surrender now and we can move on, because resistance is futile.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Wikipedia, and I pulled down this stat. So Wikipedia is estimated to have about, I think, what they say, over 100 million man hours, which I think should be person hours, but that's just me. So 100 million hours of work has been put into Wikipedia based on all of the entries. And so I did the math, and that's 11,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Did you look up how big their staff is?
No, I didn't.
Their actual company?
How big is the actual Wikipedia company?
I believe it's less than a dozen people.
You go, people. You're awesome. You go, Wikipedia people.
I'd have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure it's around that number. It's very, very small.
Yeah, definitely not 100,000, or I'm sorry, 100 million years of information.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, they don't have tons of employees. And actually, every now and then, Wikipedia will have a donation button there also.
Yeah.
Because
I do that every time.
Yeah, they need monies. They do.
So just to kind of put into context, because 11,000 years, that sounds like a lot of years. And it is a lot of years. But so I looked up on Wikipedia what was happening 11,000 years ago. And the giant short-faced bears and the giant ground sloths had just gone extinct. And land ice just left Denmark and southern Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And the start of the Holocene epoch. So think about that. That was a very long time ago. That was before the domestication of cattle.
there are tons of numbers like that. Like how many hours have people played Halo for the past, right? Since the first one. And it's way, way, way more than that.
Right.
Those stats are, they're always like mind blowing, you know?
Well, especially like, when you look at, so Wikipedia is the largest crowdsourced information pool. The second largest is the World of Warcraft wiki, which has 80,000 articles.
Yeah.
And so that, again, that's all fan run. That's not a company. That is people who are dedicated to and identify themselves as a member of the World of Warcraft community and want to contribute to it in some way. And this is the idea of giving. So you're not necessarily having to give money. So say a charity like the Santa Clauses with the bells and the whatnot. But you're giving your time. And that is just as valuable. And it also has the same health benefits as, say, giving to charity.
So of the people who funded your campaign, mm-hmm. like if you had to split them up into groups, right? So these people did it for altruistic reasons. These people did it because they were just essentially buying something. These people are going to the event and want to be there. Like, these people just want to be a part of something. They don't want to miss out. Some people, like, how do you see that demographic splitting up?
I don't think I could. I don't.
Based on the rewards that you set up?
I mean, most everybody selected a reward tier level. And, you know, I can't quantify it. I really don't know. I can go through the list of the names and identify the people who are members of the league, which would probably be about a third to half. And so I like to think that they're giving, even if they can't go to RTX, they're giving because they're part of the community and they really do care about it. You know, the remaining 50% is anybody's guess. You know, people who want to support us, people who like Griffball but might not be active, people who are RTX goers themselves. And even though they don't play Griffball, they enjoyed our presence there last year and the year before that. So they want us to come back and have that experience. Or there's people who are just nice and people who want to see other people succeed. And I think that's a large part of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, is that there's this very direct and immediate connection between what you did and the outcome. And that's where I was going with industrial organizational psych from IO Psych, is one of the ways that you assess whether somebody's happy in their job or not is if they can see the outcome of their work. So for example, if you were to put two people in two different cubicles and you gave them the exact same task of, say, entering numbers into a spreadsheet, and the person in cubicle A never saw what those numbers became, and person B, you know, once a week got to see that these numbers were being fed into this larger algorithm that was going to, say, cure cancer or, you know, help feed the poor, or even something much less altruistic, you know, somehow contributing to Goldman Sachs' earning average. The person in cubicle B is going to be much happier than the person in cubicle A because they see the results of their labors. And yeah, so I think that's one of the reasons people give, is because there's a direct correlation, a direct connection that they can physically see between the effort that they put in and what is created. You kind of feel like you have a hand in it. I helped kickstart Exploding Kittens, which was the Oatmeal's card game. Definitely did not need my help because the largest funded Kickstarter in history. But I feel like I got to be a part of it. Oh, I have a friend.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
Even more than the Scrubs guy's movie.
Really?
Yeah. Can't remember his name. I don't know why.
Or at that point.
Well, yeah, that was one of the largest ones. Okay. But right now, Exploding Kittens funded early this year, I think, or late last year. And yeah, it's the largest one as of this recording. Or alternatively, I have a friend named Pete Cooper, and he does a comic. And he's a writer, and he has a friend who has the most beautiful comic art you've ever seen. And they kickstarted a new digital comic series called Drone. And I'm not a big comic person, but I felt like I got to support my friend Pete, and that I just got my first copy of Drone via email. And there was this really warm, fuzzy feeling. I helped make this happen. And that's really cool. And that gives me the warm, fuzzy feelings that I like. Spiking that dopamine.
Are there any other examples of times you've funded?
Oh, I've funded... I have supported a lot of Kickstarters. There's one called Neurodome, which is attempting to map the human brain onto an observatory. So, you know, when you go to observatories, you can, like, lay down and look at the dome and they chart the night sky and things like that. Well, they're trying to do that with the brain. There's a video game that's kind of a film noir, and it all takes place in one room, and it's very self-reflective. It's called Sunset. I backed that. And a couple years ago, I backed one about a book on Halo communities. That still hasn't come out yet. Don't worry, guys. I'm still cheering for you. But I definitely try to back as much as I can, even if it's just $5 to show the support.
Okay. See, that example of a book that it hasn't come out after how many years?
I think in 2011 or 2012. 2012.
Okay. Yeah, that's a long time. So a lot of people. So a lot of people donate, and then they and I think rightfully so, get pretty angry when whatever it is that the reward tier for what they donated, you know, they don't get it, or the project that they funded just doesn't happen. I mean, and that there's a million different reasons why that can happen, you know, and it's not necessarily, I think it's rarely ever deliberate. You know, I don't think people are trying to scam funders, but that does happen. And at least for me, that is a deterrent many times. And usually the only times I've ever backed a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo or anything like that has been, I think once I really wanted to see a project happen.
Mm-hmm.
Only one time, because there's lots of projects that I want to see happen. But I look at it like, oh, like these people are probably going to make a lot of money off of this. Like it's a, you know, and then I do think about that idea of like, I'm essentially funding these, this business that's going forward. And again, like that's why I mentioned the thing about investing before. Mm-hmm. There's a huge difference between investing and just giving people money to go do something and make more money off of that. And I think about that. And there's a lot of things where you can see that's going to happen anyway. And I'd rather just buy it once it actually happens, because it might not happen, or it might not happen the way they want it to happen. Like it looks great in that video. The beta looks great. But then when it comes out, you know, it could be garbage. And then it's like, well, you know, now I paid for it. Now I'm stuck with it. I'd rather wait till it's done.
That's such an interesting way of looking at it, because when I've backed Kickstarters, I've never thought about, oh, I paid for it. I've thought of it as, hey, I'm helping somebody's dream come true. And whether that dream is realized or not, you know, that's not for me to say. All I know is, you know, hey, I really want to see this thing succeed. And if I can chip in $20, $30 to make it happen, then I will. You know, there's goodwill towards my friends. There's goodwill towards complete strangers. And I like to think I don't necessarily believe in karma, but it does feel cool on the other side of that, seeing people and total strangers come in and support my project. That helps kind of generate that sense of wanting to continue to give back because people gave to me. And I think we've talked about this either last week or the week before, that you are Spock and I am Dr. McCoy.
Absolutely.
So part of it is you're looking for what am I going to get out of it, which is not a bad thing when you're looking at crowdfunding. And I'm looking at, I can make someone's dreams come true.
Well, there is a difference between a $2,000 Indiegogo for somebody who's trying to record their first album, you know, and they have like a YouTube channel or something like that, or somebody who's, you know, who needs money for an operation, right? Like you see a lot of that on Indiegogo. There's a big difference between that and somebody asking for $500,000 to make a movie or a video game, you know? And I do see a huge difference between one and the other. Because sometimes, especially depending on how much we know about the people, like maybe, I don't know, like going to RTX, right? For yours, for example, it's not really, that idea of spending money on experiences versus products.
Yes.
Right? So you're creating an experience at an event, right? Everybody who is a fan is going to all of a sudden have this awesome thing with the community that they love. And that's one thing that's happening, right? It's not like you're going to make money off of that or anything like that. Now, if this was something where you were going to make money and I knew you had tons of money and you just like, you're just trying to mitigate risk, like all that stuff, I think about all of that. I weigh all of those pros and cons. So if it's a huge name behind it and they're like, well, I completely get wanting to make, what is it? Super Troopers 2, right? Just did a Kickstarter. And that's a pretty old movie. If you haven't seen it, it's pretty funny. And they're going to make a sequel. And it's one of those things where like, well, we probably like, I'm guessing that none of the studios were actually willing to publish it. Kind of like the Veronica Mars one, where they said, well, if you get this much money on Kickstarter, that demonstrates to us that more people care. So then we'll go ahead and fund the other part. So like, these are businesses, right? Mm-hmm. These are potentially things that'll make money in return, like Oculus.
Yeah, I think with the exception of Exploding Kittens, I've never backed anything that had that quote unquote corporate or industry feel to it. I mean, I know Zach Braff, the Scrubs guy I mentioned earlier, he made a movie. I didn't back that. Rooster Teeth, who holds RTX, they did a fundraiser, an Indiegogo fundraiser for their movie. And I didn't fund that because I mean, like, kind of like you said, I know they're going to reach their goal and it's going to be absurd. And I feel like they have the funds and resources to do it. And so I would rather keep my money, my $35 to my friend Pete Cooper to help Drone Happen has a lot more impact than my $35 to Rooster Teeth, who made millions. And I guess that's the social aspect of it, is I'm wanting to be more in touch with my personal friend than, say, an entity that I very much enjoy and that I am a part of that community, but I feel like there's more bang for my buck going with a smaller project.
So, and that's why I think, and I view them differently. Like, if there's somebody who puts it out as, like, this is my passion project and it's just something I've had, like, I think it's going to do good in the world and this is how much money I need. And again, it's more like an Indiegogo, something like that, then I'm more inclined to make it happen. Like I said, only once have I ever backed a Kickstarter because I wanted to see the project happen. The other times have been things where I'm essentially pre-ordering it and right. I feel like I'm getting a good deal. Because if you see a lot of Kickstarters, that's the way they do it. It's like, okay, so we expect the MSRP to be, you know, $200, but for the first 1,000 backers who donate at the 150 level, we'll give you the product. So it's like, you get, now there is that added benefit of like, well, I was a part of that, you know, I did help to make that happen, but I'm also just buying something because again, it's weird when you think about the potential of something, and it's not like I don't want people to be successful. It's just that it feels like when it's a product, it, to a certain extent, it takes advantage of people because you're bypassing this, you know, the old investment model and things like that, which I'm not saying is right or wrong, but I don't want to be a part of it most times.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the nice things about crowdsourcing and crowdfunding is that it's 100% voluntary. And
well, that's like most things.
Well, no, I just got my, did my taxes. That was not voluntary.
You don't have to do it. You have options.
No. Who was it said? The only thing that for certain in life is death and taxes. Well, you know, I think that person is dead, but taxes are still here. So one thing that I have down in like bright letters in my notebook is the ice bucket challenge. The phenomenon of the ice bucket challenge of last year.
Did anybody challenge you?
Yes, people challenged me. But
did you do it?
I did not.
Me neither. Okay.
So I figured this one, there has been research done on why this was so successful, because other charities want to be able to replicate it because it was so insanely successful. And so I'm guessing, obviously, you're familiar with the Ice Bucket Challenges, Josue, but in case anybody at home isn't, last year the ALS had a fundraising campaign called the Ice Bucket Challenge, where you would dump a bucket of ice water on your head and then you would challenge other people in your network, friends, family members, to do the same. Or they'd have to donate $100 to ALS, to that research. Didn't start out that way, but that's kind of how it evolved. And so it became this viral phenomenon where every day on Facebook, there were just pages of people on their ice bucket challenges calling out other people. Celebrities did it. I know I watched the Benedict Cumberbatch one, and I'm not going to say it was because he was wearing a white shirt and he got doused over and over and over again. That was a benefit. But so yeah, it was this really big thing, and it raised a ton of money. Probably one of the most successful charity campaigns ever.
Well, and I would argue that most importantly, people found out what ALS is. Like it created awareness more than...
Yes.
And that was more important.
That was also a big part of it too. So I'm wondering, Josue, I did some research looking into it, but why do you think it was so successful?
Why do I think it was so successful? Honestly, because everybody's doing it, so I've got to do it.
So follow the herd?
Yep, all the way.
Okay, so I guess my follow-up question would be, then why didn't we follow the herd, Josue? Well, are we going to get picked up by hyenas?
I'm anti-herd in general, so just that's my reason.
Josue, you're so hipster.
If the herd is going one way, I tend to go the other. If all of a sudden there's a herd around me, I stop and I reflect. I'm like, am I going the right way? And then, I might follow, but after some reflection. That time, I did not follow. Okay. Why didn't you?
I thought about it, and it was actually a really hard decision for me because I had a couple friends challenge me, and I decided that I didn't want to be peer pressured or bullied mm-hmm. into doing something that I didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm. And who's a hipster now?
I don't think it's hipster to not want to be bullied. I thought about it. See, the reflection piece for me came first is I thought, well, why is everybody doing this? You know, what about it? Why is this such a big thing? And that's one of the very first things I thought of. And what came to my mind instantly was that it's public. Because most of the time when you do charity work or you do any kind of donations or volunteerism, it's not broadcast. It's not, you don't go, hey, I just donated $200 to a charity. Typically that doesn't happen. And if it does, people tend to look at you as if you're bragging, you know, as if doing good works is something that should just be done and it doesn't need to be celebrated because you are doing good works. And so you do not brag about your good works. It is something you do, you know, because you are a good human being. And that's all well and good. But that's the thing with the Ice Bucket Challenge was that I don't think it was intentionally done this way, but the way that it came across is that it had to be recorded and it had to be shared. And so you kind of humble bragging about your participation in this charity event, it was societally acceptable to share it, to boast about the fact that you are helping out this worthy cause. And so that has the effect of, one, you get the feel goods because you did something good for humanity. You feel that you've done good for humanity. And because you helped raise money, you've helped raise awareness, you helped spread the word. And then two, you get to show that off. You get to show off how good of a person you are to your friends and use that as leverage to try and get them do good things too. And when I kind of came to that realization, I decided I didn't want to do it because that wasn't what I wanted to do. As circular logic as that is.
Yeah, and it sounds like accountability was a big part of that. Like, people were kind of guilting other people into it.
Yeah.
Like, that's one half of it.
I think for some people, that was kind of the fun of it, was kind of like, I dare you. I double dog dare you. So that social wanting to belong, wanting to be seen in your friend's group as not the only person who didn't donate, then, you know, what a Scrooge. And I actually have down in my notes here, reputation underscored. You know, what does that do to your reputation if you don't participate? And that wasn't something that I wanted to be part of.
Now, okay, so just to clarify the rules, right? You had to either donate or do the...
Or the ice bucket challenge. Although most people would get dunked with the ice bucket and donate anyways.
Supposedly. We don't know.
As much money as they raise, I'm sure.
Sure. So what I'm thinking about is, what's it called? Like the term Twitter activism, right? Like, I did this ice bucket thing and I just saved lives. I just did something incredible. It's like, well, did you really? Did you really?
It's so...
I understand, like, Benedict Cumberbatch has a huge following, you know? If I were a huge celebrity, doing something that simple creates awareness for the cause and it actually may have an effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I saw people, again, like on my Facebook, who they have, there's what effect did that really have? And I wonder how that illusion of how big the effect was actually had to do with how many people did it. And I mean, it goes back to what you said, you know, how we started this. It's like some people do it because it feels good. Now, I argue, like, how much good did you actually do? Is that, like...
Well, that's a different metric.
Comparable. Yeah. Comparable to how good you feel.
Well,
I retweeted that. Boom.
It's this idea of armchair activism, I think, is the term that's used. So, for example, on Facebook, during the Supreme Court's decision on gay marriage, you know, a lot of people on my Facebook feed had the red equal rights symbol in their Facebook profile picture, or people were called to do that. Or right now there's a lot of Black Lives Matter on my Facebook feed of people changing their avatars to that. And I'm really split, because on one side, I feel like even just doing something that simple is a step further than a lot of people will take. So it is doing something. And, you know, raising the awareness level and having somebody's Twitter feed or Facebook stream fill up with this consistent thing, if they don't know what it is, it might make them curious. Okay, well, why do I keep seeing this everywhere? So I do see that as a positive. But I think the difficulty is when somebody does that, and then that's all they do, and they think that's all they are responsible to do. I don't think responsible is the right word, but okay, I put my Facebook status up as this, therefore I've done my part.
And then you feel great because of how much good you did.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay to feel good about doing something, but as opposed to, you know, I mean, if people are getting satisfaction, I'm not going to tell somebody how to feel. But the idea kind of getting that the same gratification of doing something more significant at a much less cost to you, it almost feels like cheating. And I don't think it's wrong. And again, everybody's going to do it their own way. But to me, it's that sense of kind of cheating the system, is that you're getting all the feel goods without really putting in the work that typically has to go with those feel goods.
And then going back to herd mentality, if everybody in your circle is doing it and you're not, will some people view you as being against that or not being in support of that? And how many people are motivated by that?
Yeah, the idea that if you don't have, I support my troops, or, you know, that's another can of worms. I don't want to get into it.
Yeah, but then
you're anti-America.
Yeah.
So coming back to the Ice Bucket Challenge, it was something else that really struck me about it was that it was painful. You know, people who got ice dumped on them, that is a physically uncomfortable experience. And it reminded me of other charity marathons that create physically uncomfortable experiences. I mean, think about any of the 5Ks or the 10Ks or any of the marathons that go on to raise awareness. The Avon Breast Cancer Walk, the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Walk. You know, these are things that are not easy. This is not armchair activism in the sense that you are not in an armchair and it is physically demanding. And it causes pain.
Well, but actually, the Ice Bucket Challenge, because of the sudden decrease in temperature, you're actually causing a whole bunch of brain stuff happening that actually can give you like a euphoric feeling for a couple of hours afterwards.
Oh, it might, but at the same time, you're wet. And that's typically not, I mean, for example, why isn't there a dessert eating contest, a 24-hour dessert eating contest, or a 24-hour back massage-a-thon? Like, the stuff that makes us feel good, there's something about pain. Think about it like hazing. When you go through a fraternity or anything like that, there's this hazing process, and that by going through pain, the experience afterwards is more valuable because you went through this trial, and now on the other side, you have to justify going through that trial, and therefore there's this added value. And I think that kind of cognitive buy-in happened with the Ice Bucket Challenge, is people went through something, may have gotten a little euphoric, not going to say they didn't, but they went through something that was physically uncomfortable or had the potential to be physically uncomfortable. And then therefore, to rationalize that decision, you know, have to put money out or get other people to do it or go, look at this really worthy cause. Because if someone was...
They suffered.
That's the idea. I've suffered for it. And so therefore it means more. And I can't really cast stones because during the Kickstarter that I did this year and last year, we did a 24-hour live stream where we were awake for 24 hours playing video games. And that
24 hours doing what?
Playing video games.
Playing games.
Yeah.
Okay. I've done them. I've done 24-hour gaming marathons.
Maybe I'm old, but it is not a comfortable experience. Like after the end of it, my back hurt, my butt hurt, my hands hurt, my entire body was not happy with me, and I was so tired. I was almost delirious, and it just, you know, it was something that I don't like doing, but I did it for the event. I did it to raise money. I did it for the Kickstarter, and people would give more. So what we found in our stats when we did a kind of our postmortem is that what happened in the Kickstarter is in the first 48 hours, there's this big influx. And then for all the middle section of the Kickstarter, it kind of is the doldrums. And at the end, there's another big influx. That's just how Kickstarters are. But by doing the live stream, there was this hump in the middle, this dromedary hump. And that was because of live stream. Because when you're online and you're putting yourself through a challenge, shall we say, people are more likely to give. And I think that comes from a sense of empathy or sympathy. I remember at one point on the stream going, oh my God, we haven't raised a dollar in 6 hours. I'm so tired, please. This very impassioned, emotional, Kelly hasn't slept in 24 hours cry. And all of a sudden we got like $200 because people felt bad for me.
That is so weird.
And okay, Spock, I promise you, feelings are real. But yeah, the idea of going through a challenge or some kind of trial or tribulation and coming out the other side of it makes, I feel like it amps up the experience of giving or contributing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a 24-hour thing, it's like you're essentially marketing for 24 hours straight, right? Mm-hmm. So if right, probably you had, I mean, you definitely had your Twitch channel open that whole time, so there was visibility there. I'm sure you guys were like on social media and stuff like that. So it's like 24-hour push of marketing, right? Something that you don't do every day. And
thank God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but you don't have to play for 24 hours. You could have a marketing machine up and running, even automated to a certain extent.
Oh, that's just cheating.
And just doing stuff for 24 hours. I mean, just getting the message out, right? And creating awareness for it. And so if you would have done that, would you have made less money?
Well, what we found out is when we went off stream for a couple hours and we let a friend take over, that we did not get another dollar between when we took our couple hour break and when we came back. And as soon as we came back, then the money started to come again. So because we were asking and we were pushing and we were begging and pleading, whereas our person who let us sleep for a couple hours, not just because he's an amazing Halo speedrunner and he currently holds the world record, you know, he went through and it was awesome and he had his contingent there, but, you know, he's busy focusing on, you know, playing his game, whereas we were pushing something. So I don't know, but there is something about going through a trial by fire to make, one, the experience seem more worth it to you, and to make the project seem more worthwhile to other people. And I guess the last thing I wanted to say about the Ice Bucket Challenge is I found an article about it, and I just wanted to quote this. The Ice Bucket Challenge was a celebration of our narcissism. Well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. All right. That was a lot of Ice Bucket Challenge stuff.
But it's so interesting because it's such a phenomenon.
Yeah. And again, and I guess seeing that, right? It was the seeing that moment, right? Those videos were rarely longer than a minute.
Yep.
Right? Didn't take a lot of time for you to watch it, and people like to watch, like you said, the suffering. Yeah.
People like Schadenfreude. We'll just say.
Yeah.
We're all a little bit sadistic. Yeah.
And again, that wouldn't have happened without video, without the ease of being able to.
Without
to
social share. Media, yeah.
Video in particular, to be able to share that.
So technology has really enabled a bunch of these kinds of crowdfunding and especially crowdsourcing opportunities. And Josue, since you're more of the tech person, I have a couple ideas of places that have done crowdsourcing really effectively. I mean, you mentioned Wikipedia earlier. But what kind of comes to mind when you think of, other than Wikipedia, the ultimate in crowdsourcing using technology?
So it's more, the way I see it is more crowdsourcing building technology.
Okay.
So we're both using Audacity right now, which is an open source program. And if you got the latest release, for example, and you read the updates, it's like, hey, we have this new feature and it was created by this person. And this other feature was created by this person. And this feature is replacing this old feature, and it was created by this person. And we have a team that kind of does this and that. And Audacity is free. Audacity is a passion project for a certain group of people, and people can jump on and do that. And now it allows us and a lot of people to make podcasts and other audio programming. And it's people who are essentially just taking time out of their day to do this type of thing. And there's a lot of software that you're using. Unity. Isn't Unity open source?
It is.
Right. So especially in the programming world, that is huge. That is gigantic. And then of course there's like content creation and things like that. But I think that the best examples are of, you know, without the funding part, like people just actually see, because we talked about like, oh, like, you know, you struggled through an Ice Bucket Challenge, right?
No, I didn't, but yes.
Well, not you, right? But like people, yeah. Right? Not us, please.
caveat, no disrespect to anybody who did the Ice Bucket Challenge.
That's true. Yeah. No disrespect. Because I do believe that it created awareness more than anything else, which was good. Like in that sense, it was a marketing genius thing that probably wasn't intended to be as big as it was, but it worked out.
Yes.
But But there are actually people, like, using the World of Warcraft wiki as an example, and any wiki. Like, one of the things that I... There used to be strategy guides, right? For and they still make them for video games. But when I need help with a video game, I'll go in and 8, 9 times out of 10, within the first couple days, any answer that I need is there. That means that people are not only playing a video game or watching a movie or consuming any sort of content, they're actually going in and creating additional content. They are dissecting it. Some people analyze it. Some people come up with, you know, ways to help you get through a certain thing. And the way that we kind of help each other in tons of different ways is fascinating. And I think the greatest example is something like Audacity, which is created by a group of people who are not getting paid. Mm-hmm. And programming is hard. And they're creating things. They're not just copying things from other companies. Many times they're creating brand new things. They're creating their own thing and building off of something else. And this is something that is ongoing. And it works in such a way where everybody is kind of moving in the same direction. You know? Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm going to put this video in the show notes because it covers a few things that we've talked about. But it's... Daniel Pink wrote a book called Drive, and there's this really cool, like, 10-minute video. It's by RSA Animate. You know, they do, like, the animation on a whiteboard. And there's a lot of talk about why are people motivated to do this type of thing, right? And they touch on that idea of, like, it feels good when you're doing something that you know is a tangible product, or you know the result of it. It feels really good when something helps other people. And one of the most fascinating parts of it is that he says that the rewards for people, when you reward someone for doing a very basic task, like do this, do that, something mechanical, something with your hands, it is very, like, the more rewards, the greater the performance. Like, people are just like doing it. But when it comes to doing something that is more cognitive, something that is way more complicated than just if this, then that, something we have to think about, it, something like coding, something where you have to contribute to a wiki, that type of thing, the higher the reward, the lower the performance. And, go ahead.
Oh, it's the idea that if you pay somebody to do something they enjoy, it stops becoming enjoyable and it becomes work.
That's one part of it, right? Like, that's the main, like, understanding of it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, you tainted that experience for me. Now it doesn't feel as good anymore. But what if that's your job, you know? What if it's just your job? How come getting a bonus or doing something else, like, it helps to a certain extent? And what is found is that it does get, like, superfluous, right?
Yeah.
Like, once you have enough money to meet your needs, you're good. You don't need any more. And I have all sorts of issues with, like, my relationship with money. But it's so interesting that the literature, you know, this is what it says. It says that you don't have to give more money for stuff like that. And then that's why you see things like maybe people don't have that positive experience at work. So then they come home and they contribute to Wikipedia and they build Audacity and they build other open source stuff. And they're working on these passion projects and things where, again, bring it all together. You have a community of people all set on the same idea, but now people are actually doing work, you know? It is not just something simple. It is something complicated. You're, like, solving a problem, building new features, debugging. You know, you're, like, you're resolving all these different problems and reaching these new goals, and everybody's kind of on the same page. And we do it because it feels good to do that.
I like how you framed it as a passion project, because I feel it's not that you can't enjoy your job or enjoy not doing your job, but the idea that human beings seek out experiences that are meaningful. And that is one of the reasons. Yeah, and fulfilling, yeah. That meet these basic human needs of wanting to feel accomplished and competent and secure and successful. And typically, very generally, if human beings aren't getting that from their daily routine, they find other places to get it. So that's one of the reasons, theoretically at the moment, video games are so big, is because they are a very easy way of getting those things that make us feel good about ourselves. You get that. You get the sense of heroism. You get the sense of bravery. You get competence. You get to feel like you're leveling up. You get to feel like you're advancing. You get to solve problems and challenge your mind and push yourself to the edge of your ability, because that's what video games are designed to do. And a lot of us don't get that in our daily lives. And I remember before I went to grad school, I had this incredibly soul-crushing job. Obviously, it's not, you know, a meatpacking plant or picking the fields in California. So I'm grateful that, you know, it was what it was. But it was sitting at a desk, and most of the time I didn't have any work to do. And when I did have work to do, it was filling binders or making photocopies. And it was emotionally and mentally and cognitively numbing. I remarked to my husband one time, I feel like sitting here, I'm getting stupider by having this experience. And so, yeah, you go out and you try to find a way to be happy and to get those experiences. And ideally, real life would provide those for us. But, you know, that's why people, I mean, that's one of the reasons people volunteer and they donate and they give to charity, is because there's ways of feeling like they're having an impact in the world. And it's their way of coping. I guess that's one way of putting it, is coping, or just because it makes them feel good.
Well, and we can create value. Right.
Yeah.
And by doing, like, you and I spend a lot of time doing things that don't necessarily make us any money, but
like this podcast.
Although,
right? If you wanted to give us money, we are open to that. Just saying.
And damn it, you like hit a nerve.
What?
That I don't want to talk about.
Oh, okay. We don't have to talk about it. It's all right, Mr. Cardona. We can revisit this at a later session.
Yeah. What was I going to say?
I completely derailed you. Wow.
Yeah. I think I was saying, create value, blah, blah, blah. So something like this podcast, it allows us to create something that hits all those marks, right? And we're able to talk about things that we like, and it has, to a certain extent, the ability to inform people. Like, there are goals that we have, right, with what we're doing, and we don't get that necessarily from what we're doing day to day, and tons of people are doing this type of thing for that reason. It's not necessarily for fame and glory, it's to hit those points.
Yeah.
And that's why even something like a video game, right, which can be completely self-contained, that 100 hours that you spent in that RPG, like, you hit all those marks that you were looking for, right? There was progression. There was achievement.
I'm a master alchemist.
Excitement.
I am.
Right? And that helps with dealing with life. Because sometimes you just can't, you know, in your current situation, hit those marks. And it's really hard for some people. Like, it's harder for some people than others. I know people who can have that soul-crushing job and it, well, you know, there's people that, no, I'm going to change that, because some people find value in certain things and some people find value in others. So some people can have what to you and I could be a soul crushing job, and they are so excited. You know, like you mentioned, making binders. If you've ever watched Parks and Recreation, you know, Leslie loves to make binders, right?
Yes, she
stays up all night making binders. I don't want to do that. And I don't think anybody, most people don't like making binders, right? And, but some people do, you know, and it depends. So I don't know. It's cool. It's cool to be able to recognize that if, you know, people are allowed to look for that and actually pursue that, those feelings, a lot of great stuff can come from it. And that's where, again, with no money, you know, included, like not included crowdfunding, I think that's why crowdsourcing and open source is so successful. And it's made such a difference in the world, and it's going to continue to make a difference.
I mean, it's such a paradox. There's this really cool software for Twitch, the streaming software. It's called OBS, and it is completely free, and it is comparable, if not better, than all the other streaming software that is currently available. And it boggles my mind that this is a free service, because now I want to give this guy money. Because I tried his product and it's amazing, and here, take all my monies. But as if he had charged for it, you know, I might not have those warm fuzzies. But now if he were to say, hey guys, I need food money for the rest of the year, here, let me empty my wallet, because you've done this service, you've put this goodness into the world, and I want to help you now. You helped me without a thought for yourself, and so let me reciprocate. And I guess...
Yeah, and if you play your cards right, and you actually keep track of what you're doing, you can build a portfolio, right?
Yes.
Like, I helped build this. I built this component of that thing. I've contributed this much to Wikipedia or this wiki, or I transcribe this podcast. Like, you know, doing things like that, those are, that's work. That's real work. And you can include that. Just because you're not getting paid for it at the moment doesn't mean that you can't use it to actually get to where you want to go. Because ideally, we would all get paid for doing the stuff that we want, that we like to do.
Like in Star Trek.
And, yes. Yes.
So I guess the last piece that I really wanted to touch on is that we've spent so much time talking about why people donate. And then I had the thought, well, why don't people donate? And this was a very odd question for me. But after listening to you, Josue, it seems a lot more realistic now.
Oh, I've got tons of reasons why people wouldn't donate.
So I actually found an article. So your expert personal life opinion, tell me how close these are to the mark. So some of the reasons that people won't donate. So this
They're broke.
Is time or money for donating things. But yeah, the first one is the denial of the currency. So whether I don't have the money, I don't have the time, you know, that is a straight out denial of I can't do this because of X reason.
Those are very valid reasons.
Okay. The next one is a denial of benefit. So me donating my time or my money won't make a difference, which you also talked about earlier. So interesting. So far, so good. Denial of the victim. So this is more of a victim blaming approach. So, well, why should I help the homeless people? There's plenty of jobs. Why can't they, you know, get their own jobs? Why can't, which you didn't say, which I'm glad to hear, because I think that's probably the worst one.
Yeah. That didn't apply to really any of this. Yeah. Well, it did, it did in a way, not exactly in that context, but I did mention that if I know that you like are able to do it, or I think that you're able to do it, then I might not do it. Like the idea that if I know you're a millionaire and you're asking for $50,000 to do something, you know, I'm like, you're just taking the easy way out. Well, so I didn't, you know, it wasn't that extreme, but.
Well, that's actually the fourth one. The fourth one that this article had was that somebody else with money can do it. So for example, if you're a celebrity, you have the money. You know, if a celebrity is raising funds, why should I give you money or why should I donate my time? You have the resources. You don't need my resources. You've got tons. As opposed to it's their fault for being in that situation. And that one's geared definitely more towards charity in particular. But so do you feel like there's any that the article missed that you have used to rationalize not giving?
Yes, I had it in my mind and it slipped. Give me a second.
I mean, I can talk about when I haven't given, I get really uncomfortable when people ask for money. I flush red. I look away. I have a very strong emotional reaction because I hate saying no. And I try to find reasons. So, for example, I don't ever carry cash, which is a really easy excuse. It's not that I don't have the money. It's just that I don't have it with me because I never carry cash. Or I find something with the institution. So, for example, who was it? It was one of the fast food chains that had a really homophobic hiring. Cracker Barrel has a very homophobic hiring practice. So I won't do anything hosted by Cracker Barrel or anything like that, even if it is for a charity, because they are tainted.
Gotcha. Or like Chick-fil-A.
That's probably
Whole
what I was
Foods,
thinking of.
Things like that.
Yeah, Chick-fil-A.
Yeah. Where their top people are donate to anti-gay legislation and things like that.
Yeah, so even if Uber held a anti-domestic abuse rally or anti-sexism rally, I probably wouldn't contribute because I have a very bad Uber taste, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so I remember the one I was thinking, which is like a lack of feeling invested. And not as far as a benefit, but like just not caring.
okay.
You know, I mean, that one's obvious. And then, yeah, I think that's one on its own, not caring, right?
I just don't care about those starving children.
I don't give a damn about this project or that project. Now, but the other one is, so maybe I want to be on board, but I want to be on board as a more as an equal. You know what I mean? So it's like, again, that idea of investing. So if I just give you $20 and then you go off and do whatever with it, well, then that's one thing. But if I invest to, again, your Kickstarter, then I really care because I'm going to go to RTX anyway. And I think that that would make my experience better. And I think it would make all of our experience better. So I'm kind of invested in a way where it's not so much about the money, but it is about the outcome. And I think that I don't think that falls into any of the ones you mentioned, where maybe I want to donate to Oculus Rift because I believe that virtual reality is super important, but I know this is like a billion-dollar idea. So can I become like a micro investor? And that's actually something that's happening now.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the laws are set up, it's kind of difficult, but that's actually happening where there are new crowdfunding programs where everybody kind of just buys into a pot and becomes a larger investor. And maybe it's, you know, a nano percentage point.
But it's something.
But it's something. And then, you know, now your success depends on my benefit. And then maybe now that I'm invested, I'll actually, like, I'll promote it for you. And I'll tell people about it. Because now we're in this together. And most of these projects, that doesn't happen at all. We're not, it's like, it's a one-time transaction. And then we're done. But I like that idea. Like, there's a lot of them where maybe if I was given that option, I would buy in and be like, all right, I'm jumping on this bandwagon with you. Let's see where it goes. And if we fail, then we fail. But then it's a we thing. And it's not so much a I did for you.
So your new name is Stone Cold Cardona.
It wasn't enough that I was Spock before.
No. Now you're Stone Cold Spock Cardona.
I like it.
It's okay. I don't mind like being a tree-hugging like puppy like loving McCoy.
Are there any half Vulcan, half Klingon children
universe? Half Vulcans and I know of half Klingons, but I don't know of a half Vulcan, half Klingon.
I think I'd be a half Vulcan, half Klingon.
So what we gotta do is get Spock.
Cosplay!
And we gotta get Spock and Alexander from Star Trek. They're both boys, but somehow, and then remove the human. This is getting a little weird. I think we should probably.
That's it for Psych Tech this week. That's all of the Psych Tech we have for you this week. Thank you for joining us. Let us know if you have any opinions on this. You've got to. I mean, you've got to have opinions on all of this stuff because these are. This is a topic that I don't know. I've never discussed it with anyone who's just like, meh, whatever.
There's lots of feelings and passion, even if you don't have feelings and passion.
Yeah, whether you go towards the cold analytic side or the mini-feel side, you probably feel something. So I'd like to hear what people think, because a lot of the way I see it has been informed by other conversations I've had with people about this. Mm-hmm. And like you said before, like, you know, you weren't sure why people wouldn't donate, but I gave you tons of reasons.
Yeah,
I got more. I got more.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
And for more Psych Tech, visit psychtechpodcast.com or on Twitter at psychtechcast, and all our contact information is there. And as always, every Wednesday, we'll be bringing you more psychology and technology discussions. So Josue Cardona is out, and I don't like that. Okay, so
I've got the exit line for you.
You do? All right, go for it. Yes. Go for it.
Live long and kibla.
This is not a Star Trek podcast.
You said you wanted Spock, half Vulcan, half Klingon. I just gave you half Vulcan, half Klingon.
I don't know. All right, this is Josue Cardona and Kelly Dunlap. We'll see you next week.
Bye.